Wonderful. So today I wanted to present to you, this is a working title actually. This is from the beginning when Grant told me about what is this conference. And then I said, well, I have this idea that I want to write a paper. I found a phenomenon in Mark's gospel about marginalized disciples, and I don't know if you can use that, but here is the abstract, here is the working title. And that title stayed until today. Maybe it will change once I upload. I will upload. But don't ask me when. definitely for printing. So I will talk about the phenomenon of what I call marginalized disciples in the Gospel of Mark. And it's basically about relation between discipleship and side characters in the Gospel of Mark. And why I find this fascinating, and why I would like to speak about this today, and why I think this conference, I can help this conference to bring something new here, is that this relation between discipleship and side characters in the Gospel of Mark can help us today, I think, or at least make us give some answer to inner Christian dialogue, and by examples I will show you, maybe even to inner faith dialogue or inner religious dialogue. So if Jesus comes today and gathers all of his disciples who co calls themselves Christians from all denominations and divided with great walls, but all of them, I think he would quote himself, and the first thing that he would say would be probably, "Uponoite ude sinite peporomeni echetetin kardianimon," and that is. Don't you see, still perceive or understand? Is your heart still hardened? And with this question, I will start, and with similar questions, I will end. I won't offer final answers. I will present you a phenomenon that exists in Mark's gospel that is well attested in secondary literature. These are not my findings, but I want to point this phenomenon towards the inner Christian dialogue. Some of the literature I've been using are these, as you can see. It's mostly the narrative exegesis of Mark's gospel. If you never had time or opportunity to read through narrative criticism, especially of Mark's gospel, I call you to go into that. It's very interesting. Mark wrote a masterpiece, more than and we will see why. So, aims and content, I will try to raise a question or to make them, well, now it left me, but I will try to raise a question. Can we still learn from this sacred text? Mark's gospel is still a sacred text in all Christian denominations regarding the questions about canon and so on and so forth. So it must mean something to us. If it means something to us, so if it means something to us, then how do we explain this phenomenon that I will present later? And then the another question, is it expecting a response from us today? Why I say Mark's gospel is narrative masterpiece? Because Mark's gospel is more than any other gospel, is written for reader to make a response. So if you read Mark's gospel carefully, you cannot stay neutral. You must respond towards the dramatic irony, which Mark's gospel is full of, towards the out of place characters, situations, turned over, expectations, and so on and so towards his parallelisms. You cannot, towards his open end in the ultimatum. So he ends up with an empty tomb. There is no resurrected Christ. There is a call for faith. So if, and it was written for the first readers to respond to it. So is it still expecting a response from us today? And I will try to raise these questions through 4 points, three of which are I'll try to keep really short, and then the fourth one will be a little bit longer. So the first one, what is the discipleship for Mark? There's a theory of discipleship in Mark. Mark expresses what an ideal disciple should look like, what they are supposed to do, and so on and so forth. Then there are characters in Mark's gospel that are called disciples, the 12, those inside, and so on and so forth. So what do disciples look like in Mark's gospel? Do they fulfill these ideals? And if they do, to what extent? If they don't, what does that tell us? The third thing is the discipleship exclusive, and this is the most important thing, especially because of one attribute of disciples that they're expressed. And we will see, and if you ever read Gospel of Mark, you know that the answer to this is negative. No, it's not exclusive. And then, as a fourth point, I would like to bring out one character in Mark's gospel. Their story is 6 verses long. But in inner Christian dialogue and inter-religious dialogue, this character judges us, so to say, when we read about it and we hold this scripture sacred. So that's my fourth point. Follow me, not me. This is from Mark 1:17. these are the titles of chapters in my paper. So yeah, the first one about discipleship. I won't bring all of the examples. I will bring just 3 through all of them. So first of all, disciples are followers, and this is the first calling of the apostles. Immediately in the first chapter, Jesus says to them, to Simon and his brother Andrew, follow me, and I will make you fishers of people. And for later, do disciples actually follow what disciples are supposed to do? Please remember that in this first instance, and immediately they left their nets and followed him. So they fulfilled their duties. So keep that in mind. But the first is follow me. And that means not just, you know, follow Jesus, but also to believe in him, to trust him, to accept his teaching and so on and so forth. So to accept his faith. Then the authority of discipleship. And Jesus gives them exousia in Greek, the authority over the certain things. And then first in third chapter, he sends them to preach, to heal, and to have authority to cast out demons. Here, to heal is not in many representative manuscripts, so that's why it's in brackets, but I purposely put it there because that has a parallel to sixth chapter. When they actually go and do those things, he gave them, again, the writer repeats, he gave them authority over the unclean spirits, so they went out and proclaimed to preach. They cast out many demons to have authority to cast out demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and cured them. So that's why to heal is there, even though it's not in many manuscripts. And then the third thing, the most important thing, the thing that distinguishes disciples in Mark and everybody else, and today we would say the thing that distinguishes Christians or specific Christian denomination out of the ocean of other religions or denominations and so on and so on, that's truth and knowledge about this truth. Exclusive right to possess knowledge about the truth. And then after he said the parable of sower and seeds, he's interpreting his own words because apostles asked him to do that. And then when he was alone, those who were around him, along with the 12, one more remark, in the Gospel of Mark, disciples are not just church authorities. They're not just bishops. They're all whole congregation. So those who were around him, along with the 12, asked him about the parables. And he said to them, to you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God. But for those outside, everything comes in parables. In order that, and then he quotes from the prophets, they may indeed look and not perceive, they may indeed hear but not understand, so that they may not turn again and be forgiven. And then after that sentence, and here is missing the remark, last part is, I think, verse 30. After that, he tells them many other parables, and this whole chapter ends up with,
He did not speak to them except in parables, but he explained everything in private to his disciples. So disciples, we could say this, there is an exclusivity in discipleship. They possess the truth others don't have. They have a knowledge, they have a revelation, direct revelation from God, others don't have, and they don't have, others don't have right to have that yet. And if we said that Mark is exclusivist and that Mark portrays an exclusive community that is perfect and disciples are perfect and they figured everything out and they know everything, we would be wrong. Why? Having eyes, don't you see? Mark 8:18. Disciples as followers, very short sentence when Jesus was arrested. All of them deserted him and fled. Short to the point. I won't explain this. It does not need many more interpretations. Then the authority of discipleship. So he gave them power to cast out demons, to heal, to preach, to and then someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son." This is after the transfiguration scene when apostles could not heal the boy his fathers brought. And then, I won't read this because we don't have that much time. "And I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." So apparently, this power they have, it's not, they don't understand it fully, or they don't know how to use it. Something is wrong, because earlier he gave them power and we saw that they were successful at some extent, but then now we see that they still cannot use. So they're still not ideal disciples, so to say. And then discipleship as knowledge, and this is my favorite part, because this is the most important thing for discipleship in Mark. We have exclusive knowledge. And then again and again throughout the gospel, apostles and others are portrayed as those who know nothing, who have no clue what's happening. And for example, from the court chapter, after this, or actually while there was storm on the lake or on the sea, when he calms the storm, he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And two more examples of this discipleship at knowledge, and these are very important because our ideal disciples lays before these, in between these two examples. So somewhere in seventh chapter. So in the first part of seventh chapter, he has a disputation with Pharisees about what's clean and what's unclean and what traditions we should follow and so on and so forth. And then he called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand there is nothing outside of a person," and so on and so forth. And then when he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about the parable. So they don't understand. Still, they have no clue what he's talking about. And he said to them, So you are also without understanding." And then we fast forward to eighth chapter, when disciples forget to bring bread. And he tries, as every philosophical teacher, or every rabbi, in that sense, he tries to teach them something by that. But they don't understand, they have no clue. He said to them, "Be aware of yeast of watch out, be aware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod." And they said to one another, so this is after all of the healings, everything, every divine revelation, they still have no clue, or they still don't, their first association is not, this must be something very important. That they said to one another, "It is because we have no bread." That's why. And then he said to them, the question I asked in the beginning, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts still hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear?" And so on and so forth.
And then he said to them, "This all of these ends, do you not yet understand?" So we see the disciples in the Gospel of Mark are ambiguous characters. They are not perfect. The depiction of disciples in the Gospel of Mark is not that this is the saved, chosen remnant of Israel, perfect in God's knowledge, and we should all follow them. No, there's something in narrative criticism, it is called round character. So character with ups and downs, characters that appears many times through stories, ambiguous character that's not defined. So Jesus is round character in the Gospel of Mark. Apostles, the crowd is round character in the Gospel. So disciples also. And there was a great, and if you read the narrative criticism of Gospel of Mark, if you read studies on that, you will see that there is a debate about to whom is this pointed to. So if the community is supposed to respond to this, and then who are those people? And then the one of the answers, which I don't agree with, is that these are either church authorities in Mark's community or outside people from outside who came to the community and now they're making a mess by telling that they are perfect and so on and so forth. So he's purposely portraying apostles as fallible followers. I don't agree with this. I don't think that's the case. I think the idea of round character is to teach us something, and that at least that something is at least that all the humans are humans. You know, we all make mistakes. There are no perfect in there. But now, when we see that the knowledge is such an important part, and that other things, well, nobody else got power over the demons and over the sickness, and nobody was sent out to preach besides the apostles. So we can ask, and we see that they are fallible followers. Okay, they fail, but we can still ask a question: is this exclusive? So is this group exclusive group that has all rights to salvation and nobody else does not? And the answer is no. We will now turn to the little ones, side characters of Mark's Gospel. And I will here be really, really short, because first the example was following, and everybody is following Jesus, and but there are few followers who follow him until the end, and those are women in Mark's Gospel. They, when everybody else is left him, actually the women stay, and they stay until the end. And they go to the tomb, and they are first to receive the message. So there were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were those who followed him when he was in Galilee. So they did not just join up in Jerusalem. Who followed him when he was in Galilee and ministered to him. Here is the word in Greek is diakonia. And ministered to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. So they were also part of this exclusive groups, say, or they also followed the same path, at least. And then the preachers, and here I would like you to remember this this example. When he heals a demonized in Gennesaret, and the demonized asks all of the people there, they ask him, "Please go away." And then demonized asks him, "Can I come with you?" And then Jesus says to him, "Go home to your own people." What does this mean? Gennesaret is Gentile territory. Those people who are casting him out, they're Gentiles. They don't believe in Jewish God. This guy who was healed, he's not a Jew. So he said, "Go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. And then we will return back to this. And then exorcist. John said to him, "We are exclusive. Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us. Not him, but us. But Jesus said, do not stop him, for no one who does a deed of power in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. Whoever is not against us is for us. So he turns the saying, not whoever is not with me, it's against me. Whoever is not against us is with us. That does not mean they have to be with us. They just don't have to be against us. For truly I tell you, whoever gives you a cup of water, and so on and so forth. So we see that virtues of discipleship can be found in other side characters. My presentation, my paper will be a little bit longer with many more examples. And then I come to the last example because of this word, Mark 7:29. There is one character in Mark's gospel that I believe portrays discipleship more than any other character, because of not because the others don't portray what she is portraying, but because she has one disadvantage over the others, and she overcomes this disadvantage. I'm talking about Syrophoenician woman. Before we go to the story of Syrophoenician woman, I have to tell you about the immediate context in the plot, because it is very important. I told you that Mark is full of parallelisms, and you can see one example here. So from 6:1 to 8:10, this is one poll, so to say, that begins with feeding of 5,000 Jews in the desert and walking on the water, and ends, that's the parallel, feeding 4,000 Gentiles in the desert. And then healing of many, and then healing of the deaf and tongue-tied men in the Decapolis. And then disputation with Pharisees about eating with unclean hands, and Jesus in the unclean territory of Tyre, disputation with Syrophoenician woman about the similar thing. And in the middle of it stands Jesus' sentence to disciples, not to everybody else. The characters in the story, they don't know this, but disciples do. Jesus declares all food clean. And this is the story of Syrophoenician woman. I'm using David Rhodes' translation because it follows really close to the Greek text and to Greek syntax, I think. It's a good translation. So now arising from there, after he declared all food clean, he had enough with Jewish authorities. He wanted to escape. Now arising from there, he went off to the territory of Tyre, and entering into a house, he wanted no one to know, but he could not escape notice. Why? And why is this important? If you remember the demonized man of Gennesaret, he went out to Tyre and to Decapolis, and he was healed there. So Jesus is returning to that territory because he wants to be alone. He knows they don't want him there. They won't bother him there. So he wants to be alone. He's going out to Gentile territory to be alone. He is not coming here to heal. That's important. But then the suspense rises, the tension rises. Why? Because instead, immediately hearing about him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she asked him to draw out a demon from her daughter. This is the, so to say, two-step progression. Mark is also famous for this. Now the woman was Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. Mark loves this when he wants to point out, you know, something really specific. So for example, in the chapter 1, verse 32, when it was evening, when the sun set, so it was not just that there was an evening, so it was the evening when the sun set, that means when Shabbat ends, so precise moment of time. And here we see that two-step progression also. So the tension here is that Jesus came to be hidden in the Gentile territory, and the woman comes and asks him to heal. the tension rises more because Jesus actually is a healer in Mark's gospel more than in any other and especially an exorcist. So this is his area of work. But then the tension is solved. Jesus says no. And he told, and more importantly, he mocks her. And he mocks her on two levels. First one is the most obvious, he calls her a dog. And the second one is that he is, you know, putting his answer in a riddle, in parable, in allegory, that his disciples cannot solve. Because before this, if you remember the knowledge of discipleship, before this, in seventh chapter, disciples, they don't know what is going on. They're asking him about the clean and unclean food, and what do you mean? And he says to them, don't you still understand? So he's insulting her, and then he's putting that in a nice way in parable, so she don't understand. But we understand as readers, we are omniscient in Mark's gospel. We know everything. The characters, they don't, but we know. And then he says to them, Ithakur, let first the children be satisfied, for it is not good to take the bread of the children and throw it to the little dogs. And then something strange happens. She says no to him. She says, Lord, even the little pups under the table eat some of the crumbs of the little one. The dogs that are here in this story, they're not pets. They're scavenger pack animals that are going around the Palestine, you know, stealing food from people. They're not, you know, small, cute pet dogs that you walk every day. No. These are the scavenger animals. So this is really an insult. Then she says to him, Lord, even the little pups under the table eat some of the crumbs of the little ones. And something really strange happens. What nobody understands in Mark's gospel, of those who are supposed to understand, those inside, of those who are outside, the Jewish community to whom Messiah is sent out, they're in the dark, they don't want or they cannot understand. The Syrophoenician woman, who does not believe in the same God, who does not believe in coming Messiah, who does not believe in any of this, she does not belong. She's outsider of the outsiders. So she's completely another world to whom Jesus forbid his disciples to go. He said, first go to lost sheep of Israel. Don't go to Gentile towns. So she's from that part of nothingness. And she comes here. She understands his allegory. She agrees with it. Jews are the children of God. Pups eat some of the crumbs of the little ones. This is diminutive in Greek. So yes, they are children of God, but even little pups, they have a place in this world, in this work of salvation. And that's the third thing that she does. She actually expands, she doesn't, not only that she understands Jesus's allegory, she expands it. She finds a place for her daughter and herself in this world that Jesus is portraying. This is not a nice world. This world is full of insults. People are called dogs there. But there is a way, and I know the way. And if you are who you are, then this could be a way. So she's teaching God how to be God. And then he told her, because of this word, gone, the demon has gone from your body. And truly, she finds out that that demon left her daughter, and that is how story ends. This woman never showed up again in the gospel. This is an episode that when Jesus is not with his disciples. This episode, about this episode, knows only Jesus, the woman, and the narrator or author and reader. So this is really a private matter. And so why I brought out, and I'm finishing now, I'm sorry, why I brought out this woman is because she overcomes many more obstacles than other marginalized disciples in the Gospel of Mark. The woman from Galilee, they follow together with others, and they go to the cross and they stay, and it's really brave, but you know, we can assume that they're supposed to do so, or it is expected from them to do so. We can expect from people who are healed to be revealed and happy, and to proclaim that they were healed by the mercy of God, and so on and so forth. But then you have a Gentile woman who does not believe in Jewish God. She does not belong to this community, and she possesses the knowledge, the courage, the understanding, the I don't know what, of those who were supposed to have that and they don't. And now I would like to quote David Rhodes when he speaks about this this story. He ends up one of his chapters by saying, "Here is a model for leaders about how to serve, because she's actually self-sacrificing. She's going out for her daughter, trying to find the salvation for her. She heard about this healer of Judea and then came to him." Here is a non-disciple who understands. Here is a Gentile dog who is least in the esteem of Jewish culture, but who in the eyes of God and God's agent Jesus and the narrator is truly great. Here is a woman who models the values of the kingdom. And if you, and I will show this in my paper, if you point out the values of the coming kingdom of God, of which Mark is full, you can actually track down that this woman portrays them all. Self-sacrifice, unselfish love, understanding, faith, coming out, searching for, finding, later going and proclaiming, "If I return you back to here," it is after his encounter with Syrophoenician woman that he goes over his own words and goes and heals in Decapolis, in Gentile territory, among Gentile cities, and then feeds, which in Mark's gospel, there are only three feedings, 5,000 Jews, 4,000 Gentiles, and Eucharist, Last Supper. So feedings in Mark's gospel are Eucharists, basically. And then feeds 4,000 Gentiles in the desert. So I said I won't offer any final answers, and I end up my presentation with this.
Yeah.
If Mark's gospel. If Mark calls us to respond, how do we respond?
Thank you so much, Veljko.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful, very moving to see your eyes, through your eyes, how you notice these characters that we don't usually notice. The eyes just go directly to the main characters, but you have revealed how this woman had the answer to the riddle, and I believe it was a riddle, and the disciples were expected to answer it, and they were expected to oppose it and say, "But Jesus, this is not the way to respond to this woman," but she gives the answer instead. So I just wanted to share a small experience from last night, where I went into town and I met this Syrophoenician woman. I went into a store And the woman behind the counter saw that my card was Greek. And she said to me, "Oh, I came to your country. I am a Syrian woman from Turkey. I came to your country as a refugee." And some of the Orthodox there, they told me I'm not a Christian. And I said, "No, I'm a Christian." And I took out my cross and I showed it to them. They said, "No, you're not a Christian." She said, "No, I know I'm a Christian. I believe in Christ and he's my savior and I'm a Christian." And she had so much courage. She knew who she was. And she stood up for herself. Wow, she was in such a vulnerable position in a strange land, in need of them rather than them in need of her. But she knew who she was and she claimed her faith and she stood by her faith. She also had the opportunity to say to me, "Your people, you guys didn't treat me well," but she didn't place me in this. She was so kind and loving and smiling. And I said, I thought, who am I to judge the faith of this woman? She's so, her faith is so much stronger, so superior than my faith. So I'm connecting this experience I had last night. I was so humbled. And it really gave me an insight into the importance of what we are doing here. This is really where the kingdom is being built, and in these encounters and in this kind of eyes to the text to seek out these women, these characters that we wouldn't normally consider the believers. So I just wanted to thank you. I don't really have a question, but I wanted to thank you for this and say I'm very moved.
I don't really get the mic.
Belko, thank you very much. Laurie, would you be able to say just a little bit more about that phrase, because of this word? One could look at that in thinking there was almost a quid pro quo going on, as though, God's mercy is bottled up and somehow this woman has done something to release it. What do you think is going on there? What do you think Mark is trying to tell us in framing it that way?
Well, let me return. So if you look at it as I was pointing out, that it is because of her understanding and because of everything she and because of everything that her word bears. So she's trying to find a way for salvation of somebody else, then that could be a virtue of kingdom, and it is not a quid pro quo, if it's put like that. But of course, it could be interpreted as you said, and we have to be careful there. So yeah.
I'm sorry, could you just repeat that? What you just said, I didn't quite catch your.
I'm sorry. So if it's interpreted as as I'm understanding it, that this word is not something that she's just saying. It is not just basic understanding, but everything that this word bears. So her going out and seeking for salvation, and then when she comes to the obstacle, and she has to overcome this obstacle. So narrative analysis can be much sterile. I'm trying to reduce it here as much as possible. So this is a character that comes to an obstacle, and they it seems impossible to solve it, but they solve it, and they solve it in an unimaginable way. The another example is the woman caught in adultery. Yes. In John's gospel, they present to Jesus an impossible choice. Basically, she's dead, and now it is just a question if he is going to be dead also. And he's presented with an impossible choice: Moses or love. And then he finds a third way, and I think that's how God usually works. He's a subtle, and that's one of his greatest attributes. So, yeah. it could be answered like that.
Thank you, Eriko. I'm just thinking, do you think there is some kind of when the Lord says, let first the children be satisfied, or it is not good to take the bread of the children and throw it to the dogs? So there is some kind of psychological intuition from the side of the Lord, if we can speak in those terms, that this is exactly what she needs to hear in order to reach the full potential of the situation. Her response, the Lord triggers the reaction. Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, can you repeat?
I mean, is the Lord triggering the best possible reaction on her side?
It could be. It could be. I found in narrative interpretations that I found a sentence that says Jesus forces her to beg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that could also be a case. But I would like to think that she actually changed his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And if we analyze this narratively now, full sterile biblical, analysis. Nothing with the faith analysis. So it seems like that. If we follow the narrative, it seems like she actually changes his mind. And he's so moved by that he stays there and he goes out public because he doesn't want to go out public. So that's the beginning. But after encounter with her and after her word, he goes out public and he heals and he preaches and he feeds. So the gifts, and those are all the gifts of the kingdom in the Gospel of Mark. So the gifts of the kingdom are given to the Gentiles also. This is the story about boundary crossing, so to say. And I think that to put everything on God here, he knew that she will answer and that it diminishes her character and her importance. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say that importance. Maybe God knew, okay, we can tell that. But it was her effort. She could just turn around and leave with all the potential in her. Okay, she had the potential to answer this riddle, but she could just turn out and leave. Or started crying, or started actually begging, but she chooses to, or actually narrator is portraying her is, she specifically chooses to answer this riddle, to acknowledge it, to understand it, and to expand it. So the worldview that Jesus is here portraying fits her and her daughter.
Maybe the both are true at the same time.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It is a Pentecostal question, I guess. I think this verse, this interpretation, this verse would be loved by Pentecostals, I guess, in that you can in some ways convince or even twist God's arm in a sense to have access to something of God that somehow it also belongs to you in a sense. I guess the corrective that people like me within Pentecostal circles want to bring is that is to what extent can this be stretched out to where you said in the book end with this open ended mm-hmm. thing that faith is required to not know what the result can be and things like that. So so I think that is this tension in which there is desperation and pursuit, and God honors that. But to what extent can you go to comment on the relationship faith has to how God acts in the world? I guess that's more of a theological question that can create all kinds of problems for certain theological systems. It's just a comment and maybe even a response.
Yes, I agree with you. It's a full theological question, and it's a and it's not in the story, because it, and it has to be answered also, and everybody has to answer this in their own way, and I don't want to raise any fights here, but if we stay with the story, just with the story, just with the narrative of mine, then there are no final answers. That's the kind of a message of Mark. There are no final answers, even though the narrator, he will impose his worldview on you. He will tell you the first verse of Mark's gospel that only you know about is, this is the gospel of Jesus, Messiah, Son of God. And nobody in the story, in the narrative, later narrative, nobody knows that he's a Messiah, Son of God, and they have to discover this. But you know as a reader. So Mark will impose this on you, these kind of things. And he will, for example, in the third chapter, he says that the Herodians and Pharisees, they gathered together and decided to kill him. This is the foreshadowing of his trial. And the reader already from the third chapter knows that the verdict is already there without a trial, without everything. But then there is a mockery trial. So why do we have trial? There is a question. Why do we have trial in Mark? So that reader can judge the hypocrisy of Pharisees and Herod and whoever else, Pilate, the soldiers, and so on and so forth. And on these tensions, these unanswered questions, Mark actually builds what's called dramatic irony and open-endedness. So, yeah, and I like it in that way. And I sometimes like to stay with it. With question and think about it privately.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks.